So we're continuing our study of Sefer Melachim Aleph, and we're up to Perek Hey, Pasuk Vav. Continuing to talk about the wealth that Shlomo had amassed and the grandeur and greatness of his kingdom. We read twice already how the people were really, the average citizen in both Yehuda and Israel and the entire country was living well and living in tranquility. Pasuk Vav mentioned something that's rather disturbing, in that it represents something that maybe we won't read about so much now, more towards the end of Shlomo's life, but it had to do with how many horses Shlomo had amassed for himself, and it sounds like very early on in his time of being king, because we're still here. This is approximately the fourth year after he started being king. Pasuk Vav says, "Vayihi l'Shlomo arba'im elef urvos susim l'merkavo." Shlomo had arba'im elef is 40,000 urvos susim is translated as stalls of horses, which sounds like where they're kept. L'merkavo for his chariots. Ushnemasar elef parashim, and he also had 12,000 horsemen, those who would ride the horses. The description in Divrei Hayamim mentions the number 4,000 perhaps the explanation is that there were 4,000 stalls. Each stall held about 10 horses, and it was 40,000 horses. It's an extremely large amount of horses, and one of the things that the Torah in Parshas Shoftim, when the Torah has the Parshas HaMelech, the command to make a Jewish king, so first and foremost, it's understood by many Rishonim that the command to have a Jewish king is understood to be an optional mitzvah, what we call a mitzvah reshus. You don't have to have a king. If you choose to have a king, this is the rules and regulations for the king. You could potentially choose other forms of governing. But one of the things that a king is not allowed to do is a king's not allowed to, he's not allowed to have too many horses. He's not allowed to have too many horses. The number one concern is too much of a reliance on the land of Mitzrayim. The land of Mitzrayim, the empire of Egypt at that time, was the place to get horses. Yeah.
Shouldn't we keep in mind that he's only 16 years old? I mean, isn't that relevant at all? I know he was very smart and very mature.
I think we can keep it right.
16 years old.
I think it's.
He liked a lot of horses.
I think it's fair to keep it in mind. Yeah, I think that's fair. At the same time, he's held accountable. One of the things that we haven't seen is we don't, and I don't necessarily have an approach for it. We don't see his advisors. We don't see. Who's his royal council? Right. That Nasan Hanavi, his mother Bathsheba, Ben Yoyada, others who we don't even know. We heard who his officers were, but is it that every decision is being run by a council? Clearly Ben Yoyada and Nasan Hanavi, they know what it says in Sefer Devarim, where the Torah says not to have too many horses. So was Shlomo taking counsel, or was he just acting on his own?
More than he had 1,000 wives.
Well, yeah, we'll get there. Right, not at all. So the Torah says you can't. The Torah cautions the king not to have too many horses, not to become too dependent on Mitzrayim, and not to have to go to Mitzrayim. And in general, horses represented power and physical power. That's not supposed to be the goal of the Jewish king. The goal of the Jewish king, the seat of the king's power, is the relationship that the Jewish people have with Hashem in terms of their Shmiras HaMitzvos. That doesn't mean they don't have an army. It doesn't mean they don't have a normal amount of horses. But to have, right, even the phrase horse power, that power came with who has the biggest army, will be seen perhaps as being the most powerful. But the Jewish army is never allowed to put all of its faith in terms of numbers. Some of the Mefarshim understand that Shlomo was was basically saying there's a gezeira. Normally, when we say the word gezeira, we refer to a rabbinic decree. So most rabbinic decrees have a reason, right? You're not allowed to take medicine on Shabbos, lest you come to grind up, you know, with the mortar and the pestle, lest you come to grind up. So I'll be the guy, I'll just violate the decree, because I'm not gonna come to do the reason behind the decree. I'm sure there are people who do that. Shlomo was basically applying that logic to what is considered to be a din d'oraisa, a mitzvah on a level of the Torah, is that he was saying it's not going to happen to me. I won't rely on Egypt. I'll be able to have all these horses from Egypt without relying, without going down to Egypt often, and sort of saying that, yes, the Torah warns, but since the Torah kind of gives the reason of the reliance on Egypt, I'll make sure that that doesn't happen. And it could very well be that if you take the other mitzvos the melech, you could say that there are kind of these reasons behind, right? Amassing an immense amount of wealth. That was also, the king is supposed to not have so much wealth. He's allowed to have wealth, but he shouldn't have over, so he doesn't become haughty and be too haughty in his being king. So again, you could say it's not going to happen to me. And maybe Shlomo was a victim of the fact that he had so much wisdom that he thought he was wiser than all. And in certain respects he was, but that doesn't circumvent the Chachmas Hashem, the wisdom of Hashem, to go ahead and give this command of not having so much horses.
Going along with your thought of not depending on Egypt as the reason for not accumulating so many horses, the first thing he did was marry an Egyptian princess.
Right. So again, that's... You know, that's not necessarily in the direction of depending. It's to try to have positive foreign, relationships.
Did he get the horses through the marriage? Did he get the horses through the marriage?
Maybe.
Not sure. It doesn't seem to be. Listen, there definitely was friendly lines of communication, probably due to the marriage. We don't hear more about the horses for now, but it does plant a little bit of a seed. And you know, if, I don't know if you want to create a larger theory in terms of Shlomo's downfall seems to come through the excess of horses, eventually the excess of wives, specifically in the areas where the Torah said the king should be cautious about excess. So again, but we don't, you know, in the back of our minds, because we know the end of the story to some extent, and how the dynasty of Shlomo does not continue with the same vigor and strength that he had. This is just a seed, because the next psukim go back to talking about very positive things. Pasuk Zayin. The kilkelu hanitzavim ha'ela es hamelech Shlomo. The commissioners, all the officers that we mentioned in the previous perek that had the job of sustaining the king, the melech Shlomo, and maybe we're mentioning this again because now they also have to sustain all these horses. Meaning there's a lot that needs to be sustained. Ve'as kol ha'karev el shulchan hamelech. And anyone else who came close, anyone who came to the table of the king, so far we've been kind of hinting to it, and we've been, the Mefarshim have been explaining it to us, but we'll actually have very soon, the Psukim are going to inform us of how many, or at least the types of people, and the directions of who was coming to the kingdom, to see Shlomo, to be with Shlomo, to marvel at Shlomo. So the pasuk is telling us, after hearing about this whole list of horses, that those who are responsible to bring sustenance and to bring food, each man was responsible to bring 1 month's worth. Lo ya'adru davar, and the Mitzudas Tzion defines the word ya'adru as yichasru, so not being chaser at all, not missing anything. Rashi says, what does it mean, not missing anything? So things were so good in terms of what was being grown. So we know we take it, we take it for granted, I think, living in New York, that there are many fruits that you can go ahead and buy any month of the year. Sometimes they may be more expensive. Sometimes you might have to go, I don't know, in Manhattan, is there like a, I know there's a flower market and a fish market. Is there a fruit market somewhere, like the Fruit District, something? A block where there's like... So you might have to go, it might not be in the local Acme, but you're many fruits you're going to be able to get all year round, even though we all know that fruits have seasons. That's why it's a very, one of the complicated areas in Hilchos Brachos is the bracha of Shachianu on a new fruit. Everyone always wants to make a Shachianu on a new fruit. The idea, again, you can feel free to talk to who you need to talk to. The idea behind making a Shachianu on a new fruit was thanking God that you lived till the new season of pomegranates. Because there used to be a time that you could only get pomegranates once a year. We live in this lovely world where, okay, it's during the winter we get our pomegranates from I don't know where. And then during the summer we get it from, again, I don't know where. But if you want a pomegranate all year round, you can have a pomegranate. So it's on a halachic level, it's very hard to say, you know, you can make a shachianu on a pomegranate, on a date, on a fig. Okay, there may be some fruits that are that actually have a like a season where you can only get it during this time. Obviously, everyone always goes nuts about it for the second night of Rosh Hashanah, because how could you have the second night of Rosh Hashanah without a new fruit? The answer is you actually can have the second night of Rosh Hashanah without a new fruit. And if you didn't have a new fruit, you can still make your Shachianu out of deference to the opinion that it's like one long day and that, you know, we shouldn't make a Shachianu. We try to have a new fruit. Trust me, your great grandparents didn't always have a new fruit in the middle of the fall. There weren't available. So Rashi says, "Afilu she yemos hachama b'mos hagashamim." They were able to take a yemos hachama fruit, a summer fruit, and have it show up on the table of Shlomo even in the winter. And the opposite. And Israel does have a season. So how did that work? So I don't think it means that they were so agriculturally advanced that they were able to grow things, but it could very well be that the lines of trade were just so successful that they were able to bring in. So each, right, we had said that each zone in Israel wasn't divided based on tribe, it was divided based on land, of what they needed to provide. They were able to provide, everyone was able to provide equally, so that the apples were always coming, even though apples were not necessarily in season. So lo yadru davar, it doesn't just mean that it wasn't missing anything that from the quota, it means that each one was able to bring forward the same amount, the same quantity, the same quality, and even the same fruits as the previous groups. Pasaches, the hasaorim, the barley, the ateven, and the straw, lasusim, for the horses, v'larechesh. Rechesh, what's rechesh? So the mitsudos... Exactly. The Mesudos Tzion cites the Megillus Esther and says it's a type of animal. It's a min behema. It's a type of animal that runs very fast. So what Art Scroll translated it as the speedy mounts. I think that, you know, I don't know what a speedy mount is. What is your translation? The swift steeds. Okay. So
more literally.
Yeah. It's not a sus. It's something faster than a horse, but similar to a horse, probably somewhere in the horse family. There was a lot of food, a lot of animal food needed, right? Saorim, barley is usually considered to be the basic animal food. Barley was of lesser quality than wheat. You know that Eretz Yisrael is blessed with two grains. It's blessed with wheat and blessed with barley. From a Tanakh perspective, wheat is always considered to be more refined and meant for humans, and barley is meant for animals. My dad likes to say some story that when his grandfather came, I don't know if it was on the boat or after getting here, they offered him some type of salad, and he refused to eat salad because he said it was Michael Behema, like to eat leaves, you know, from his... So the Torah, when the Torah wants to, by the carbon of a sota, so if the Isha sota was actually guilty, so her action was less human and more behema. So the Torah requires that the mincha be brought from Sa'orim, as opposed to a regular Karban mincha, someone just wants to bring, they're in the mood for a Karban mincha, or the Karban mincha that's offered as a component of a regular Karban comes from wheat. So here, Sa'orim is brought, Sa'orim is the food for the horses, the tevin, the hay, the straw. They need straw, they eat straw, I don't know. Straw is necessary. Yavio el amakom, they brought it to the place, asheyu sham ish mishpato, they brought it to the place wherever those horse stalls were, each one according to his responsibility. So even though we didn't hear about them before, but after mentioning all of the horses, apparently each of the regions had a responsibility to provide for the horses as well. We now have some level of a summary in terms of the chachma, in terms of the wisdom of Shlomo, and the impact that made on the world at large. A world that was not as interconnected as our world could possibly be, but as we'll see, the renown and the fame of Shlomo spread throughout, I would say the world, but I imagine it means the region more. It's a pasuk tes. Vayitein Elokim chachma l'Shlomo. Hashem gave wisdom to Shlomo. Usvuna harbe ma'od. And a lot of understanding. The way to comprehend these different terms is perhaps simply you would say chachma and tzvuna. Chachma is like raw wisdom, and tzvuna, understanding, is the ability to apply wisdom, the ability to understand, to discern, to analyze. The rochav lev, and he had a very wide heart. This is not the first description of his wisdom, but here, and this is not the first description of the word lev in terms of his wisdom, in that the wideness of his heart in terms of that emotional wisdom, that ability to perceive people, things in that nature. It was as wide kachol, like the sand, al sfas hayam, that's upon the sea. The phrase the Radak says it's a language of usually wideness. You wouldn't necessarily define wideness like the grains of the grains of sand in the sea, the grains of sand by the seashore. So usually that's in terms of number, right? When the Jewish people are described, that you can't count them. You count it like the grains of sand. What does it mean that Verochav, that it was as his heart, his understanding heart was as wide? It maybe means the different perspectives that he was able to have in terms of his wisdom. And then we start to compare his wisdom to others in Pasuk Yud. Vaterev Chachmas Shlomo, his wisdom was even greater, mechachmas kol bnei kedem, from the wisdom of everyone of the East. Everyone of the East, I think, is a reference to the settled areas, you know, from the time of, you know, what we would call early Mesopotamia, the Babylonian, where Avram Avinu comes from. All kol bnei kedem, all of the region. Umikol chachmas Mitzrayim. You kind of have these two zones. There's the east of Eretz Yisrael. There's the south, which is the wisdom of Egypt. And Shlomo's wisdom was more than both of those regions. So we have his wisdom is compared to areas. The next pasuk compares his wisdom to actual individuals. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayechkam mikol ha'adam. He was wiser than all men. He was wiser, me'etan ha'ezrachi, someone named Etan, the Ezrachite, the Haman, the Chalkol, the Darda, b'nei Machal. Three individuals, let's say for now, one named Haman, Chalkol, and Darda, who were all the sons of someone named Machal. So we'll talk about those people in a second. But the totality of him being wiser than any region, than any of the regions and any of the individuals, Vayishmo b'chol hagayim saviv. His name began to be, Vayishmo, his name was present, b'chol hagayim, and all of the nations saviv, all of the neighboring countries started to hear about the renown, started to hear about the fame of Shlomo. So who are these individuals? Why would they be selected? We'd say, you know, they must have been pretty bright, because Shlomo is being mentioned as being brighter than them. So who were they? So the Rashi initially, quoting from Chazal, Rashi identifies, Rashi thinks that they're all, the whole list, this Eitan, Haman, Chalkol, and Darda were actually all from the tribe of Yehuda. Rashi quotes, they were four brothers. They were all the sons of Zerach, the son of Yehuda. Zerach, who was, right, when Yehuda and Tamar produced two twins, there was Peretz and Zerach. Peretz, that's who the Davidic line comes from. Zerach had four sons, and these are at least four of his sons. They perhaps are the ones who are mentioned. There are certain chapters Rashi cites from Chazal. There are certain chapters in Tehillim. There's a chapter, right, Perek Peches and Peites. One starts with Maskil le'Eson ha'Ezrachi, Umaskil le'Heman ha'Ezrachi. These are individuals they were able to compose even some of Tehillim. We know that David HaMelech is famous for writing most of Tehillim, but the Gemara in Bava Basra tells us that there was a group of individuals that took part in writing, right? To say for Tehillim is 150 chapters. Not every single chapter is written by David. That's why there are definitely a few chapters in Tehillim kind of end with the phrase of like, almost like, these are the Psalms of David. Kind of like almost, and it almost sounds like it's like a little bit of a capstone. But if he wrote the whole book, how would you? You should just have the end of, right, chapter 150 that we say is part of our Psuki Dezimmer every day. That should have it. So that's one approach. There is another approach quoted that Rashi cites a Medrash that it's all representative. These individuals, these names, they're code, right? Adam is code for Adam Harishon. Right, that says that he was vayechkam mikol ha'adam, that he was wiser than all individuals, than Adam Harishon. Me'etan, so one of the nicknames of Avram Avinu was Eitan. So anyone who has a relative named Eitan, I imagine they might know that. If not, it's interesting to note. We say, right, where do we refer to Avram as Eitan? In the Shmoneh Esrei for Yamim Noraim. Either in our private Shemoneh Esrei or just in the Chazan's repetition, there's a phrase of like, I'm not catching it offhand, but something Eitan, and it's a reference to
Ahavas
Eitan. Right, that's a reference to Avram Avinu. So that Shlomo was wiser than Avram Avinu. Haman is a play off the word Ne'eman. The Ish Ne'eman was Moshe Rabbeinu. Chalkol, who was the Chalkol? We had that word very recently in terms of Kalkala, the ultimate provider of food. That's Yosef. Vidarda is a word that represents Dor Dea, the generation of knowledge, the generation that left Mitzrayim. Bnei Machol refers to that same generation who received Mechila from the Chet HaEgel. So that what the Medrash is seeing in this pasuk is kind of throughout, you know, a quick snippet of Jewish history that came before Shlomo, whether it be from Adam to Avram to Moshe to Yosef. You're going to ask me, it goes out of order, right? Haman is Moshe, and Chalkol is Yosef. So that's a proof. What's it a proof to? This is going to be a joke. Not like a funny joke, but it's going to be a joke. What's a joke? So by the Ushpizin, I don't know if you've noticed this, by the Ushpizin of Sukkos, so there's different orders to the Yushpizen. There's the classic, unfortunately I'm going to be a little bit haughty and only speak about Ashkenazim and forget about the fact that there's a whole tradition of Sfardim. But there's Nusach Ashkenaz, this classic Ashkenaz, and then there's Chassidim. They have a different order. Classic Nusach Ashkenaz goes in chronological order. Makes sense. You have Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef, Moshe, Aaron, even though they're also, but we always say Moshe, Aaron more, even, I don't know, but they go Moshe, Aaron, even Aaron was older. But Moshe, Aaron, and then David is at the end. While Chassidim go, and again, depending on your sukkah decoration, you have to know what's going on. It could be a little confusing. You have Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and David. So why did Chassidim do that? Well, maybe it's because of the Pasuk here. Well, not the Pasuk, but the Medrash. I don't think so. But the reason why Chassidim do it that way is that each of the Yushpizen also represent a different sphera in the Kabbalistic orders of things. The sixth sphera is aligned with the idea of Yesod, which has to do with being a tzaddik. Yosef was known as Yosef HaTzaddik, so sixth is always more important and it's aligned with Yosef. So that's why they bump Yosef. That's why in a Hasidic shul, it's insulting if you give the Rebbe Shlishi. You have to give the Rebbe Shishi. Shishi is the most coveted aliyah in a Hasidic shul, and Shlishi is the most coveted aliyah in a... Yeah, exactly. So, that was just in jest. But the Medrash can go out of order because, okay. But what the Medrash is adding is just an idea of these names. Maybe they don't represent actual individuals. I mean, you'd almost be like playing 2019 sensitivity. Like, is this really nice that they selected? Oh, by the way, he's even smarter than these guys. You know, these guys are even, like, so... Again, whether they were actual individuals or they more represent different parts of history. However it was, it all built up, right? The second half of the pasuk is really coming off of the previous two psukim, is Vayihi Shemo B'chol HaGoyim Saviv, that his name started to go all around. A Hasidic interpretation, the Art Scroll quotes from Vayechkam Mikol HaAdam, is that how did he get smart? Like the Mishnah in Avos says, "Ezhu chacham halomid mikol adam." Right, veyachcham mikol adam. That the part of his wisdom was being able to learn something from everyone and pick up right and maybe in a lot of his interactions, as we're going to see, when he starts meeting people from foreign places. So the wise person will take wisdom that he hears from different lands and incorporate that into his own wisdom. Pasuk Yudbeis. Vayedaber shloshes alafim mashal. He spoke 3,000 parables. Vayhi shiro chamisha v'elef. And his shirim, his songs, were 1,005. So when you take this pasuk literally, you're left scratching your head. 3,000 mashalim, 3,000 proverbs. Where are they? Right, 1,005 songs. So we all know Shir HaShirim, we know Koheles, we know the book of Mishle. These are three Sifrei Tanakh that are attributed and that are they're authored by Shlomo HaMelech. But it's not 3,000 mashalim. It's not 3,000 parables. So the Radak's approach is very simple. He says, Eina nitzayim etzleinu. We don't have it, right? The Radak is a Rishon living, I don't know his years exactly. I'll say 1300s. So he says it's very simple. They got lost. They got lost in the Gullus. They were not made, perhaps part of the reason why they got lost, they were never incorporated into the Sifrei Tanakh. They were never canonized. So they were there. They had value, but they just got lost. The Rashi wants to say a little bit differently. That Rashi almost he doesn't want to be as literal in terms of that we're talking about numbers. Rashi almost it's like he translates the word alafim as like teachings or lessons. Rashi says shloshes lomdei mishalos. There were three teachings of parables. Shalosh pamim kasuv mishle shlomo b'sefer mishle. Sefer Mishlei could be, you can take Sefer Mishlei and you can divide it into three sections. There are three sections that basically say these are the Proverbs of Shlomo. And there are three ways to divide Perek Aleph, Perek Yud, and Perek Chaf Hei of Sefer Mishlei. Obviously a very rich Sefer. So there are three sections. So each one is talking about a section. There's another approach to say that each of the mashal, right, open up a Sefer Mishlei, there's so many meanings behind the Proverbs and the Mashalim, the parables of Shlomo, that it means that it is talking about Sefer Mishlei. And the Sefer Mishlei that we have, which is 31 chapters, right? There's one chapter that we all know very well, and we know it by heart, right? You know it by heart. Chapter 31, you know by heart. Eish Hischayah. Eish Hischayah. You know it by heart.
That's half the chapter.
You know by heart.
That's half the chapter?
Half the chapter. It's half the chapter.
Oh, it's only half?
I think so.
Okay, there you go. So you know, half a chapter. Half a chapter. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think my wife was learning for a bat mitzvah project with a young girl. I don't know if it was from here or from school. And the mother came up with the idea to learn Eish Hischayah. And basically, my wife had a 45-minute learning session on every like two psukim with this girl. They learned for a number of weeks. I mean, there's so much layers. We know that there's so many layers to all of Tanakh, but Mishlei in general, it's so layered. So maybe the 3,000 mashalim are really included. The 1,005, right? The Shiro Chamisha va'elef, so Rashi again, it doesn't translate the word elef as a thousand. Like, we have these thousand songs, so he rather says it's five songs. Which five songs? So Rashi's approach to make it work is each section of Mishlei is like a song, and he wrote two songs. He wrote Megillas Koheles, which is like a song, and he wrote Shir HaShirim. Mm-hmm. Or the other way is, no, Shir HaShirim is so rich, so maybe, you know, it's like so many numbers. If none of those approaches work with you, you know, it's fair to say that in a society that everything was handwritten, and a society that went through an immense amount of gullus, even the you know, if you somehow, myself included, keep this in mind, the up and the down of the Malchus Yehuda, even before the first Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, let alone the exile, the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, the exile to Babel, maybe going back to our, you know, we could imagine that things were lost along the way. But it's impressive nonetheless, and perhaps also we point out that Shlomo had an ability, specifically when it comes to a mashal, to use images and to use parables as a way to explain, or as a way to teach the values of the Torah. That if the Torah represents the wisdom of Hashem, so the wisdom of Hashem is perhaps something that we can't fully grasp, and so by making the use of mashalim, of parables, that's a way to incorporate the das of the Torah. It happens to be in Sefer Shmuel, there was a pasuk that refers to the Torah itself as a mashal. The Torah is called the mashal hakadmoni. And Rashi in Sefer Shmuel says that it's the kadmon shel olam. It's the original one. I think that's what my dad told me. I once asked him, what does the Yiddish word ebishter mean? And there's a term ebishter, it refers to Hashem, but what does it mean? We know Hashem's names, they have some meaning, right? Ribono Shel Olam means the master of the world. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the one who is blessed, or he who is blessed. What does Ebishter mean? And where are Yiddish speakers? Ebishter.
Hashem.
Right. So my dad thought it might mean this idea of like Kadmon, the original, like original one, the really old one, the one the one who was always there, kind of that translation. So Rashi said, Rashi explains this mashal ha-kadmoni means the kadmon shel olam. The Torah itself is a type of mashal, because to understand the wisdom of Hashem, it has to be put into a way that humans can ingest and understand. And so Shlomo had that koach, even though we think we open up a Mishlei and we're like scratching our heads. I think even Art Scroll has that they won't. I think Art Scroll doesn't want to translate Mishlei word for word without any explanation, because it's just too hard. So I think, I don't know, they write in the front, maybe they're translating, like they're using Rashi like automatically. If you read the English, you're getting Rashi because you just need to make sense of it. But it was an ability, the power of Mashal was the ability to take the ideas and the values of the Torah and give it over to people. So he's renowned for this. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Vayidaber, he also spoke al ha'etzim. He spoke about wood. He had a knowledge and spoke about wood, min ha'erez, from the cedar, right, the cedar, which is very, very tall, asher balavanon, which is in the, from Lebanon, the arzei alvanon, which we're going to read about either later in this parak or in the next parak, vad ha'ezov, all the way to the hisap, which is a asher yotzei bakir. It comes out of the wall, right? The shrubbery that grows out of the kotel, right? Big shilas about that. What do you do if you cut that off? What do you do with it? Right? If they clean it off, is it holy? Because it grew out of the wall. Okay. Vayidaber ala behema, he spoke about animals, vala oaf, and about birds, vala remes, about the creepy crawly things, vala dogim, and about the fish, that there may have his knowledge. Rashi says, what does it mean, ala eitzim? That Shlomo, part of his knowledge, and we had already hinted to his knowledge about nature, is that he had a great knowledge about the world of refuah, the world of medicine at that time. Which plants are good for what? What plant is, or what tree is good to plant in which area? Which soil is good for which? Plant? The Medrash Rashi cites says that it meant that he understood when the Torah makes use of items of nature, whether they be laws that have to do with plant life or animal life. He understood the real meaning. He understood why. Right, it talks about oaf and behema, why it is that when we shecht, when we slaughter a behema, you have to sever two of the simanim, but by an oaf it just has to be one. Why is there ritual slaughter by animals, but by fish there's not? Because coming to the intricacies, or what we would call chukim of the Torah, things that we don't really understand, that Shlomo was able to have, he was able to have an understanding. In terms of his nature, in terms of maybe his wisdom on nature, so you would take the same approach that the Radak explained. It could be that there very were. There were books of medicine and books about nature. They just didn't make it. Pasuk Yud Dalid, to kind of echo what we said just two psukim before, that when we said by Yishmo b'chol hagoyim saviv, right, his name got out there to the world. But now we hear finally in verse form, Vayavo mikol ha'amim. They came from all the peoples. They came from all the nations. Lishmoa eschach ma Shlomo, to listen to the wisdom of Shlomo, to be exposed to this great, you know, wonder of the world. Me'es kol malchei haaretz, from all kings of the land. Asher shamu eschach ma so, who heard his wisdom. Whether the kings themselves came or they just sent their representatives. To hear Shlomo's wisdom, whether it means that they wanted to make use of Shlomo's wisdom, to ask him advice and things of that nature, or just to marvel, right? You know, imagine there was like one computer in the United States of America that was able to do everything, and none of us had computers. So it would be like a thing to travel to see what is a computer. He was a human computer. Now what would probably be interesting, which I don't know if it's true, homework assignment, you know, are there any records of that? Of Shlomo's renown in other cultures, in other, right? Because if they came back and they told the king about the smart Jewish king, is that anywhere? That is beyond, way beyond. I'm sure someone in Hebrew U will know the answer. Not that I have a contact there, but or Bar Ilan or any of those places. But those are the type of people who would think about it. But it's something that, you know, you'd have to imagine that it made the newspapers in all those countries, whatever, they didn't have newspapers, but it made the stone tablets. Yeah. There's the impact that Shlomo made. And this is before the grandeur of the Beis HaMikdash, which also played a heavy role in attracting people to Israel and to Yerushalayim and to the court of Shlomo. That finishes that section about Shlomo's wisdom and the impact that it made. And Shlomo's kingdom is really set. He has everything settled. Everything's going well for the people. Everything is going well for himself in terms of having the wisdom and managing. But there's one thing missing, and that's the Beis HaMikdash. And so we begin, Pasuk Tezvav, a correspondence and a relationship that existed between David and the king of the north, whose name was Hiram. In Divrei Yamim, his name is pronounced slightly different. And in terms of who initiated the correspondence, Divrei Yamim almost sounds like Shlomo initiated the correspondence, but here we see that it was Hiram. Pasuk Tesvav. Vayishlach Hiram melech Tzor es avadav el Shlomo. Hiram, who was the king of Tzor, which is on the Mediterranean coast in the north. Today I think it's Lebanon. Tyre, T-Y-R-E. And we're going to see that he wasn't just the city of Tyre. Again, you can check this out on a map. You might have how's your map doing?
Yeah.
There you go. So do you see Tyre? Does it have Tyre up there? Right here. So you can show everyone.
Oh, yeah.
So there's Tyre. Exactly. And as we'll see, he was also king. There's a city just slightly north of that, Sidon. Or Sidon. They're both port cities. The major cities in Lebanon, modern day Lebanon means, the major cities are all in the port. Beirut is also very close to, you know, it's on the water. When you have access to the Mediterranean Sea, that's a huge part of your economic abilities. So Hiram was a king in the north, and he sent servants to Shlomo. Ki shama, because he heard, ki oso mashchal amelach tachas aviyu. He had heard that he was anointed in place of his father. Ki ohev haya Hiram leDavid kol hayamim. Hiram had been a friend to David always. And has assisted David in building parts of Ir David. Why Hiram waits until now to kind of, if you will, extend an olive branch or just extend friendship, it could be that the impact of Shlomo's renown made an impact even on Hiram, that he had such a close relationship with David, and now that he finally sees that it's quite the worthy son who has taken over in place of David, he wants to continue that friendship.
Doesn't necessarily mean that he sent it now. He may have sent it many years ago.
And he's only taking advantage of it now.
He's young.
Could be.
Vayishlach is the past perfect. Something that transpired before.
And now Tezayin, Shlomo taking advantage of it is just when Shlomo needs it now to get ready to build the Beis HaMikdash. I've never found a proof to this, but I grew up in a small shul in Kew Gardens Hills. There's a man who sat next to me. His name was Mr. Tabak, and he really only spoke Yiddish. And he sat next to me, and during like the between the Aliyos, he would always be telling me like Divrei Torah based on like Rashi in Yiddish, and I don't understand Yiddish, so I would just kind of nod and say Yar, I can do that, and I was just better off doing that than just fake it till you make it. I never made it, So, but he was a Holocaust survivor. He was very, very special. He wouldn't like the Kiddush here because he liked everyone sitting for the Kiddush. He was very machbid that if he sponsored the Kiddush, everyone had to sit. They put food on the table that people should sit.
He can come sponsor our Kiddush.
Yeah.
Well, I think he's sponsoring Kiddush in a different olam right now. But so he, the one thing that I really think he told this to me was that he knew about some medrash that Chiram, who helped out David build some of Ir David, and Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash. Again, it's a medrash, so we can play the miracle card. Is the same individual as Chira, who was Yehuda's friend in the story of Tamar. I never found it. If it exists, it would, you know, the idea being is that it's some foreign not Jewish individual helping out Yehuda. And then there's this parallel, you know, it's a good many hundreds of years later, but it's the same idea of this non-Jewish individual helping out the great-great-great-grandchild of Yehuda, David, and then Shlomo. So whether it exists or not, but there's some type of, there's a connection, and I don't necessarily see anyone talked about the significance of the fact that so much of the assistance to build the first Beis HaMikdash came from, you know, what we call a non-Jew, which is always a hard, you know, the term non-Jew is a very hard term, right? I think when Elon Gold was here, he was poking fun at it, right? There's 7.5 billion people in the world, and we call them, we're 14 million, we call them non-Jews. But the truth is that here we're talking about the beginning to gather some. I mean, we know that Divrei Yamim quoted David had done a lot of gathering, but there was still the Beis HaMikdash was a very large project. I don't know if anyone explains this, or maybe it's just obvious. The Beis HaMikdash was not supposed to be only a place for Jews. We say it in Yeshaya. We call it. It's right. Right, we say Vaviosim Ahakratzi V'simachtim Beit Tfilati Olzehem V'zivchem L'ratzonim V'zvuchi Ki Beisi Beis Yehu. It's for all. It's for all nations, and they say the Gemara says that we know that the 70 cows that we brought on Sukkot each day starts with the Karban Musaf changes each day. It starts with 13, goes down to 7, so 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7 equals 70. You'll do the math later. So the 70, the Gemara says it was represents the 70 nations of the world, and Kom Shmini Atzeres is just one to represent Yisrael. So the Gemara says that had the nations of the world known what those karbanos offered on their behalf did for them, had the nations known, not only would they not have destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, they would have sent their armies to protect the Beis HaMikdash. I said that once as a Dvar Torah in a certain sukkah. For certain purposes, I won't say which sukkah. And then, so the very next day, the person decided that we should invite the non-Jewish neighbor to come for lunch. The only problem is it's like a little techno. You're not really supposed to invite non-Jews who aren't part of your household, who aren't like your nanny or your au pair or things like that. On Yom Tov Shabbos, you can, but not on Yom Tov. But they heard my Dvar Torah and they're like, oh, we should be inviting the nations of the world to the sukkah. So the root is this chiram. So maybe I don't know. So pasuk tazayin vayishlach Shlomo el chiram. So Shlomo sent back to chiram, saying as follows. Lamor. Pasuk yedzayin. Ata yadata is David avi. You knew David my father. Ki lo yachol livnos bayis. He was not able to build a house l'shem Hashem elokav for the name of Hashem, his God, mipnei hamelchama asher sevu, because of the war or wars that surrounded him, ateis Hashem osam, until Hashem gave what's the translation of the word? Tase. Gave them tachas kapas ragloi, under the soles of my feet. So Shlomo is being a little politically correct here, where he says, my father wasn't able to build, right? You knew my father, David, that he wasn't able to build a house for Hashem because of the war that surrounded him. In Divrei Yamim, we had explained that David wasn't able to build the Beis HaMikdash because he fought in wars. Mm-hmm. Past. His hands were bloody. The Beis HaMikdash is a place of kapara, is a place of forgiveness. The Beis HaMikdash couldn't be built by someone who had so much blood on his hands. It had to be built by a Shlomo, a Shalem. It had to be built by someone who was full of peace, someone who didn't know battle. That was one approach. We had seen in Sefer Shmuel a number of approaches. One of the more, I'm not going to say beautiful, but in terms of, kind of seeing David, Hashem basically was saying to David that if you build the Beis HaMikdash, I'm never going to be able to destroy it. You're so dear to me. David is so dear to Hashem that if David would build it, Hashem wouldn't be able to destroy it. And in the end, the Beis HaMikdash, I don't know if they're Psukim in Tanakh or just Midrashim that refer to the Beis HaMikdash as a mashkon, as collateral, that Hashem basically said, either I'm going to destroy the people or I'll destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Hashem destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, and that's why we're still here. Save the people. But in terms of David, if it possibly had something to do with David's actions, Shlomo doesn't say that. He just says, my father was busy fighting wars. And it may be a reference that happens to be that the three mitzvos that the Jews are commanded to do when they come into the land. So they're supposed to appoint a king, they're supposed to destroy Amalek, and then they build the Beis HaMikdash. And maybe the idea is until there's no more war, you don't build the Beis HaMikdash. So my father wasn't able to build the Beis HaMikdash. The Mefarshim point out the sensitivity of language, where he says, "Ki lo yachol livnos bayis l'shem Hashem," for the name of Hashem. It doesn't say to build a house for Hashem, because that might, right here he's talking, what Hiram believes, if he was a monotheist, we don't know. We will see a pasuk where he praises Hashem. So clearly, at least on his list of gods, if he had multiple, Hashem was on there. But if you say you're building a house for Hashem, so okay, Hashem's going to be in this house, and if he's in this house, he's not in the other house. So that's that. To dispel that, puts the emphasis on the phrase l'shem. Pasuk Yud Ches. Va'ata, and now, Hiniach Hashem Elokai li misaviv. Hashem has granted to me, Hashem has given to me respite, misaviv, from all around. Ein Satan, the ein fegara. No one, there's no enemy, there's no pigua, there's no pegara, there's no meeting of misfortune. No one's meeting for bad. Pasigotes, v'hinini omer, livnos bayis, l'shem Hashem Elokai. So behold, I say to build a house, again, l'shem Hashem Elokai, for the name of Hashem, my God. Kasher diber Hashem al David avi leimor, like Hashem spoke to David when David had that fervor in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel Beis, I think it was Parag Zion. David has this fervor that he wants to build a house for Hashem, and Hashem says, no. Bincha asher etein tachtecha al kisecha hu yivne v'havayis l'shmi. Your Hashem told David, my father, your son, which is now me, asher etein, that I'll give in place of you on your throne, hu yivne habayis l'shmi, he will be the one to build a house for my name. Let's just do one more pasuk. V'yata, and now, so now Shlomo's coming to his request. He's given his introduction. Tzavei v'yichrsu li arazim min alvanon. Command and cut for me the tall cedar trees from Lebanon. V'avadai yu amavadecha, my servants will be along with your servants. Uschar avadecha etein lecha, the wages of your servants I will give to you. Kecho asher tomer, everything that you say. Ki ata yadata, you know, ki ein banu ish yodea lechors etzim katzidonim. The best ones to cut down trees are the the ones from Sidon are the ones from Sidon. So we need your expertise. I'm going to contribute. The Mefarshim have a little bit of a debate. Where was the wood coming from? There was a region in the north, in this, you know, the Ya'arei Lebanon, the forests of Lebanon. Part of it was within the boundaries of Shlomo's Israel, and part of it was in the kingdom of Hiram. So the Mefarshim debate, was it from Jewish land? Because he doesn't talk about paying for the trees. He only talks about paying for the workers. So maybe it was from Jewish land, but we don't know how to cut down the tree. Meaning they were so big, you have to, there's a certain chachma to cut down the tree. Maybe it's a certain chachma to, you know, you don't just want to cut down the tree. You want to cut down the tree so that it's usable and you know, I don't know how to cut down a tree. But I imagine there are different, more destructive and more use of ability to still use it. And other Mefarshim say no. He was getting it. It was foreign wood, but it was considered to be the best for the task at hand. So, Be'ez Hashem, next time we will continue with Pasuk Chaf Aleph.